CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
GEICO presents unhelpful home improvement how-tos.
Overhanging trees present a real danger. During high winds, falling branches can damage roofs and windows. So today, I'll show you how to protect your home by wrapping it in bubble packaging. All you need is a staple gun and 142,000 feet of bubble packaging. Let's get started.
You could try to protect your home with bubble packaging, or you could get covered for personal property damage through the GEICO Insurance Agency. Call GEICO and see how affordable homeowners insurance can be.
Today on Face the Nation, Republicans rejoice after passing their tax bill. The president gets his Christmas wish and signs the bill into law. But will this Republican unity last into the new year? We'll take a look at the political landscape heading into the 2018 midterms. And in our annual CBS Correspondents Panel, we'll reflect on this year and look ahead to next. It's all coming up on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. On this Christmas Eve morning, with all the newsmakers out of town, we begin with a 67-year tradition, the annual CBS News Correspondent Roundtable. Joining us this year, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan. Ed O'Keefe covers Capitol Hill and politics for The Washington Post and is a CBS News contributor. We've asked him to fill in for congressional correspondent Nancy Cordes, who we hope is enjoying her well-deserved break with her family. Chief White House correspondent Major Garrett, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Pagaz, and National Security correspondent David Martin is also here. We begin with a portion of an interview Margaret did with Vice President Pence late last week on a surprise trip to Afghanistan. She talked to him about the accomplishments of the first year of the Trump administration and what's ahead for 2018.
This president has rolled back federal red tape in record numbers, unleashed American energy, appointed conservative jurists to our courts, including Justice Neil Gorsuch. But to arrive at the end of the year, and thanks to President Trump's leadership, to see the Congress of the United States come together, pass the largest tax cut in American history, was deeply inspiring.
You see a toehold to get more done.
As much as we've accomplished this year, rebuilding our military, unleashing the full potential of the American economy, and passing the largest tax cut in American history, and other initiatives that this president has advanced, it's clear we're just getting started. And next year, I think you're going to see this administration move on vigorously to an agenda which will include infrastructure and welfare reform. The progress that we've made in the war against ISIS, where we've virtually crushed the ISIS caliphate and taken back its the capital of Raqqa, the fight here in Afghanistan, taking the fight directly to the enemy, the investment that we're making in our military, the growth and optimism in the American economy, I think sets the stage for tremendous growth and opportunity in security and prosperity in 2018.
How do you explain to the American people how they should understand what just happened this month with Mike Flynn pleading guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with the Russian ambassador, which the president said he lied not only to you about, but to the FBI, and that's why the president fired him?
We'll let the special counsel and others do their job. Well, we're going to cooperate, but we're going to stay very focused on the job the American people elected us to do.
Can you just clarify how you understand what happened with Mike Flynn, who we'd known had lied to you? Did you know he had lied to the FBI? The president said that's what made him fire him.
I stand by everything I've said with regard to that individual and every other aspect of this. But
when he was fired, did you know he had lied to the FBI?
What I can tell you is I knew that he lied to me. And I know the president made the right decision with regard to him.
All right, Margaret, so the vice president is a fan of the job his boss is doing. Let me ask you about that trip, though. It was supposed to be part of a larger trip that the vice president was supposed to take. That part was canceled.
Well, it's interesting because that trip has been postponed until January. It was supposed to be to Jerusalem. And also to Egypt, part of what had initially been planned as sort of a look, I delivered on this promise to eventually move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And then it became a bit more of a trying to soften the blow that was very much dealt to all of the Arab world and the Palestinians. But as more and more canceled their planned meetings with the vice president, that's made that trip tougher. But this bomb that was dropped in many ways with this decision on Jerusalem, the administration would say we didn't see the blowback on the security side, the risks and the threats that some had predicted. But you have to understand that symbolically, the decision on Jerusalem will continue to be a sticking point for the Arab world. It may not be the breaking point because they have broader concerns with Iran right now, but it is certainly something that the administration is not going to quickly move beyond.
Major, we heard the vice president's assessment of the year. Give us your assessment.
I think it was very revealing in the last week of this year, effectively in Washington, that the person who had the year-end wrap-up press conference was not Donald Trump, was not Speaker Paul Ryan, it was Mitch McConnell. And if you're going to look at the person singularly most responsible for the accomplishments on the domestic side for the Trump agenda,
well, good morning, everyone.
It's not Donald Trump. It's Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who held, with the exception of one issue, health care, Republicans together on every single aspect of what the president tried to accomplish. Tax cuts were passed because McConnell held his conference together. All of the 12 circuit judges nominated and confirmed, a record for any first year of any American presidency, because Mitch McConnell held his conference together. And he got 49 votes on health care, closer than anyone probably could have under those similar circumstances. So Mitch McConnell put the bow on this year, and quite properly so. The president signs, but without McConnell, who for the very first time this last week, the president actually praised on Twitter, because it has finally gotten through to him, through many people inside and outside the White House, Mr. President, forget what Steve Bannon says. You can't get anything without Mitch McConnell.
Ed, staying with Congress, you heard Mike Pence talk about him, about infrastructure. You heard him talk about welfare reform, given what Major's laid out, but also the fact that you got a Democratic Party that doesn't want to help out this president. What do you think Congress is going to look like?
The more likely of those two is infrastructure, for sure. It was quite revealing how very quickly this week Paul Ryan tried to pivot to entitlement reform, and very quickly Mitch McConnell and Republican senators said, no way. Because remember the math, 51 to 49 is the new math starting January 3rd. Doug Jones comes to the Senate as a Democrat from Alabama. And
courtesy of Steve Bannon.
Courtesy of Steve Bannon, exactly. And cooperation is required. And the only thing that most senators right now believe could start the year off in a good way is working on some kind of plan to fund big construction projects, basically, in this country. The question, of course, as it always is, seems to be, how will you pay for that? And given that you've just slashed tax cuts, Republicans will probably turn around and suggest that entitlement reform is the way to do that in some respects. But a lot of those Republican senators and a fair number of congressional House members who are from suburban swing districts, where going after Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security is an unpopular thing to do in an election year, are going to resist it.
David, the vice president said ISIS is decimated, the caliphate is gone. Is that accurate? And if so, why has it been, why has this come to pass?
I think it's accurate to say that the caliphate, as it existed in Iraq and Syria, is crushed. They used to control all of northern Syria, northern Iraq, western Iraq. They're now down to a few pieces of territory along the Euphrates River in Syria. And I think the Trump administration deserves some credit for that. The weight of American airstrikes and the capabilities of American special operations forces would sooner or later crush the ISIS caliphate, no matter who was in the White House. But the way that General Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, went about it was to give his commanders more authorities to make decisions in the field. So when they saw a target of opportunity, they didn't have to come all the way back through the chain of command to the White House to get approval. They just did it. And now the ISIS that once existed is almost dead. But as Secretary Mattis says over and over, they're not defeated. ISIS, the caliphate, is going to become ISIS, the movement. And its followers, we already see them in Afghanistan, Somalia, Yemen, name almost any country in North Africa. These aren't fighters who, for the most part, escaped from Iraq and Syria. These are just angry young men looking for a cause to serve.
Jeff, the vice president talked about Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn is at the heart of both the relationship with the Russians among Trump advisors, but then also the obstruction question about whether the president told the FBI director to go easy on the Flynn investigation. Where are we at the end of the year with these cluster of investigations?
Well, they're ongoing. And the question is, I know the White House is interested in this, when will it all wrap up? And it doesn't seem like there's an end in sight right now. I mean, you have Mike Flynn, who was given this plea deal. He is a figure that straddles, you know, the transition, the campaign, and the first few weeks of the White House. So if he's cooperating with investigators, you get a clearer sense of what the investigators may be looking at. At least according to some of the people that I know who have worked with Mueller in the past, they know how he builds his cases. He tries to get some cooperating witnesses, which he has now with Flynn and Papadopoulos, the foreign policy advisor who also took a plea deal. So you wrap up these witnesses, but you don't tip your hand, according to these people who work with Mueller, to what the main charges are going to be at the end. So that's the question. When will this end, and what are investigators trying to get out of Mike Flynn?
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break now, but we'll be back in a minute with more from our panel. And we're back with our panel. Major, I want to start with you. There have been a lot of management changes at the White House.
Yeah.
Where are we at the end of the year on that?
John Kelly has brought order and discipline and a functionality to not only the way decisions are brought to the president, but who is allowed to bring them to the president. And they go through John Kelly. But that doesn't change the fundamental truth about the Trump approach to the presidency. And I've been trying to think of a metaphor. So you go to a rock concert. It's the Make America Great Again rock concert. There are two songs, Forgotten Americans and America First, and 15 solos. 15 solos by the same soloist on different instruments. That soloist is Donald Trump, okay? When he says in interviews, I'm the only one that matters, he fundamentally means that. And everything about this administration pivots off of that truth. He is the central actor, the central soloist in everything. And imagine yourself at this rock concert and you hear 15 solos. You're probably going to be a little tired by the end of the show because you get the soloist and very little else. And if you talk to cabinet secretaries, which I have the luxury of doing at some time, they're like, we're doing all these things, but it's hard to sort of get people aware of it. Because the soloist is on the flute, then he's on the drums, then he's on the electric guitar, then he's on every other instrument. And that is both the kind of reality draw of the Trump presidency, the management reality, and the exhausting reality.
Right. By the time he gets to the Glockenspiel, it's really... Margaret, I want to just pivot right from that to the question of the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. Give us a sense of that powerful job. Is Rex Tillerson going to stay in it? What's his legacy?
Major's right. There's only one star in this show, and everyone in that administration is keenly aware of it. In the past few weeks in particular, you've seen Secretary Tillerson be a bit more assertive. Particularly, you see this in this newly assertive position, perhaps in Ukraine, to open up this idea that we could express more support and actually provide lethal weaponry to the Ukrainians, which is a shot across the bow at Russia, which you've heard Tillerson say time and again, this is the one issue of Ukraine where we can't get past this to broker that broader deal with Russia. So I think you will continue to see him quietly move on that front, along with more sanctions on Russia, along with more assertive position, and also be more outspoken in the new year. But he clearly doesn't want to try to compete with the star in this show on the main stage.
Right. We're going to see how long we can extend this metaphor. David, let me ask you about North Korea. Where does that stand at the end of this year?
365 days further down the road of a collision course. The U.S. is making a demand of North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons program that North Korea is not going to accept. North Korea is developing a weapon, an intercontinental ballistic missile, that the Trump administration says it cannot accept. Something's got to give, and it's probably going to take some major decisions by somebody in the year 2018 to get us off this this collision course.
Jeff, what's the state of Homeland Security at the end of this year?
Well, the main focus, John, right now is on these lone wolf actors. You know, law enforcement doesn't like to call them lone wolves because they feel it glorifies the act. But these are people that are harder to spot because they're sitting in a basement somewhere being radicalized online, and with the array of information available online, they can be radicalized within weeks and then carry out an attack. The FBI does about 1,000 investigations ISIS-related in the U.S., and really that's been the consistent number over the last couple of years. But spotting these people is so difficult because they blend in. You don't really have a history of law enforcement with them. And so trying to wrap them up and get them arrested is a problem for law enforcement, and it's something that will continue into 2018.
And I want to end this round by talking about Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, their relationship with the president now. It was a rocky year. Is everybody on the same team now, or are there things coming in 2018 that you think will create more potential conflict?
Well, this was by far their best week, and I think you saw that in their public praise of each other, the body language. And the fact that they all understood this was a significant win, not only for them, but for the Republican Party and its existence. But I think you're going to see some more disagreements about what to do next year, both officially and politically. There are competing priorities, obviously, in the House and the Senate. McConnell doesn't really want to rock the boat. I think Ryan is eager to try to take another step in terms of looking at sort of domestic policy and what could possibly be reshaped in a more conservative image. Both of them struggle every day with the fact that the president does not grasp, care about, or really, you know, talk to anyone about details of this stuff.
Major, I want to ask you about the underreported story from the year. What would you put in that category?
I'd say one overseas and one at home. Overseas, it's this relationship with Saudi Arabia. When I covered the Trump campaign, I did not imagine the very first stop he would make overseas would be Riyadh. Considering his orientation to the Muslim world in general and the possible restoration, in the words of the Saudi kingdom, about Islam and taking on terrorism in a way that it didn't before, could be a potentially far-reaching story. At home, I would say it's energy. This administration has a 20th century point of view on energy extraction and exploitation. It does not have an embrace of renewables or 21st century energy concepts that the Obama administration does that will radically change where we drill, where we don't drill, and the environmental implications of that.
Margaret, what's your candidate for undercovered story?
One thing I would highlight is what we're seeing in terms of the lost generation. This refugee crisis that was so focused on Syria has now continued, worsened, become a health epidemic, whether you're talking about conflict in Yemen, outbreak of cholera hitting thousands, whether you're looking at the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where UNICEF is predicting 400,000 children under the age of 5 could die because of these health risks, because of refugee crisis, issues of displacement and starvation. So whether it's Syria, Africa, you know, throughout the Middle East, these issues the United States isn't talking about as much, isn't leading on, and is really only articulating in purely a homeland security point of view. But these things have consequences in years to come in terms of radicalization, in terms of risk, and in terms of simply health risk.
David, what's been an undercovered story?
Well, you heard Vice President Pence say we are rebuilding our military. Not so much. There's a big new defense spending bill, but it's just a wish list until you get a deal in Congress. And so the fact is that the Pentagon, along with the rest of government, is going to continue to operate on these continuing resolutions, which keeps you going along the same path. And the heads of all of the services just say that their readiness is falling apart. And when you listen to the details of what an aircraft carrier has to go through these days to get underway, when we saw those three carriers operating off the Korean Peninsula a while back, the machinations that it took to get one of those carriers, the Teddy Roosevelt, underway, I mean, they were stealing planes from all over the United States, stealing parts just so that they'd have an air wing to go on there. The Secretary of the Air Force says that when she saw on her first briefing on the new readiness rates when she came into office, she said, there must be some mistake. This has got to be wrong. And, of course, it wasn't wrong. And nobody should conclude from that we're about to be inferior to anybody. We're still number one. But as the Secretary of the Air Force said, these decreased readiness rates don't mean we're not going, but it does mean fewer are going to come back.
Your candidate for this?
Two quick ones. First off, let's remember there was an assassination attempt on a top House Republican this year. And this was the most threatening year for lawmakers in history. There were at least 1,650 threats against lawmakers as of late July. I couldn't get updated stats in time for this, but it's safe to surmise it was at least double last year. The other, there's an internal displacement crisis in this country. At least 230,000 people have left Puerto Rico since Hurricane Maria. They are in Florida, Georgia, Texas, North Carolina, New York. They're going to reshape the politics of those states. But there's an island that needs to be rebuilt, and the United States didn't do it this year.
I would agree. I think, you know, Puerto Rico is just what has happened there and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and the lack of focus on those issues there is big. That's not exactly my beat, but that's something that I'm interested in. But also, if you look at overseas, European officials were saying that they're not getting the outflow of ISIS fighters back into Europe that they were anticipating. I talked to top counterterrorism officials here in the U.S. who agreed with that.
All right. Prediction time. Jeff, I'm going to start with you. What are you going to predict in 2018?
Well, you might recall that last year I predicted that James Comey was going to stick around. Maybe you can give me a break on that.
You're a humble and honest man.
Well, I mean, who knew what would happen? So this year, I won't be as bold, but I will say that I think the Mueller investigation is going to, one way or another, give members of Congress a big decision in 2018. I think it's going to, it'll end up in their lap.
David, what's your prediction?
Well, as long as we're confessing, last year I predicted that President Trump and Kim Jong-un would have a face-to-face meeting. I was brilliant, but dead wrong. So I'm not going to touch North Korea. I'm going to predict that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, will meet his end in 2018.
All right. Ed?
One of the big four congressional leaders, Nancy Pelosi, Paul Ryan, Chuck Schumer, or Mitch McConnell, will either be gone or on their way out of their position by this time next year.
All right. Ranger?
The president is going to have to come to terms with what the resistance means. If you talk to Ed Gillespie, who ran in Virginia, got more votes than everyone ever run for governor in Virginia, but lost by 9 points, mm-hmm. So the victor got even more, says, I've met the resistance, and it's real. In the midterm elections, everything that's on the agenda will have to require Democratic votes, and that's going to mean larger compromises than this president has shown any inclination to achieve. So 2018 for this White House and this president, if it has any accomplishments at all, will have to be through and over or around the resistance, and that will be a fascinating story.
Margaret?
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson does not resign in January, as had been predicted and asked many, many times. He'll stick around. I think he will be engaging more and more assertive, as I said. But I think one of the areas that is going to really take up a lot of his time is trying to save whatever chance at diplomacy there may be with North Korea. But we may see also a more immediate crisis with Iran.
All right. Thank you, Margaret. And I want to thank everybody on our panel today. For today, but also for all the work you do for CBS and for Face the Nation. Your reporting, your insights, and your curiosity about the news and what's going on in Washington and around the world help us inform and make sense of what's been a very unusual year. And we'll be back in a moment. If you can't watch the entire show live, the full hour of Face the Nation is rebroadcast every Sunday at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time on our digital streaming network, CBSN. Available through our website, the CBS News app, or your favorite TV device. And we'll be right back with a lot more Face the Nation. Stay with us.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device. CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. The big political question for 2018 is whether Republicans will build on their single-party control of Congress, or whether Democrats will flip control of the Senate, the House, or both. For a look at where things stand as we move into 2018, we turn to Dan Bowles, who is the chief correspondent at The Washington Post. His colleague, Karen Tumulty, is a national political correspondent. And our own Anthony Salvato is the CBS News Director of Elections. All right. First, we're going to get to the House and the Senate and break those down. But I want to just start with a very broad question for all three of you. Dan, I'll start with you. What does the landscape look like here at the end of 2017 for next year's elections?
Everything we see at this point, John, is it is a very, very difficult landscape for the Republicans. Almost every measure or every event that has happened so far this year politically has been bad for the Republicans and good for the Democrats. You can look at it in terms of the president's approval rating, which is historically low for a first-term president. You can look at it in the nature of the current preference for how the House should break. The Democrats have a significant advantage on that at this point. And we know that from the recent elections, the enthusiasm is much greater, or appears to be much greater, among Democrats than Republicans to turn out. And that's often the key indicator in midterm elections.
Karen?
It's true. Midterm elections, especially in a president's first term, are almost never good news for the president. In fact, only twice since 1934 has a president's party picked up seats in the first midterm of his first term in office. But it really does seem like the Republicans are, in fact, heading into some really tough weather here. And it's true, the generic ballot, this, you know, would you rather see a Democrat or a Republican in office? The Democrats are ahead in that by double digits. But I agree. I think this enthusiasm gap is really the biggest thing the Republicans ought to be worried about right now.
I want to get at the roots of that enthusiasm and where it comes from. But, Anthony, where do you put the needle down on the record here?
Let me temper that a little bit. The math is still a little bit in the advantage of the Republicans, at least on the Senate side. And the reason for that is that the Democrats are defending more seats. And any time that happens, you have a harder hill to climb. And look, on the House side, it's true that we see in national polling that more people are now saying that they'd like to see the Democrats in control. But remember that those polls are talking to people in very heavy Democratic districts as well as heavy Republican ones. And so that generic ballot can sort of overstate the case, right? What you really want to focus on is how many specific House seats could be competitive. And on that side, there may be just enough for the Democrats to put the House in play. The real question going forward is, can they expand that map? Can they make more seats that we wouldn't ordinarily think are in play sort of come into view?
On that generic ballot, though, isn't it the case, this is this question of would you vote for a Republican or a Democrat, even though it's an imprecise number, when it's that big, when people are favoring the Democrat that much, isn't that sort of, well, a blunt indicator? When the number's that big, it still does tell you something, though, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It gives you a general sense of the direction. And there's no question that that direction is pointing towards Democrats. It's maybe about half as many. So if you see a national ballot, you know, a national generic ballot, you say, well, they might win maybe half that much in the actual elections. But there again, the interesting thing is going to be where they can start to try to persuade people. And as you look around the country, a lot of these suburban districts, a lot of wealthier districts that had gone Republican on economic issues particularly, are places that they're targeting. And if they can start to put those in play, then we start to see a really competitive House election.
I think the first place to look will be there are 23 House districts, and the Democrats have to pick up 24. There are 23 House districts where there is a Republican incumbent sitting in a district that was won by Hillary Clinton. And these districts are all over the country. They're in California, Texas, Florida, and they're a big range. A lot of them are suburban, but a lot of them are rural, and a lot of them have large numbers of Hispanics.
John, yeah. There's one other element in terms of the tempering of where we are. We have a odd situation, which is a president with very low approval ratings at a time when you have historically, or over the last 17 years, the lowest unemployment rate, a stock market that, as the president says constantly, is breaking records weekly, and steady economic growth. So for the Republicans, if they can, in one way or another, force people to think about the state of the economy rather than their view of the president, they could hope to do better than a lot of this polling suggests at this point. history says that, well, there have been two other times in the last half century where you've had this anomaly of low presidential approval and low unemployment. In both those cases, the presidential approval turned out to be the more significant, and the party in power lost a lot of seats.
Yeah. In the last three midterms, most people have said that their midterm vote is about the president. So there's no question that he's a factor, and there's no question that approval rating look like it looks
and
like.
And that's where the enthusiasm you're talking about, Karen, comes from. Explain that for people a little bit about it's linked to the president, right?
And what pollsters ask voters is, you know, how excited are you about this election? How they look for other measures of how engaged people are with the fact that there even is an election this year. And just this week, the Wall Street Journal, Peter Hart, their pollster, found a 10-point enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans.
You know, that's really important, too, because, remember, in midterms, turnout is lower. And the folks who tend to vote are a little disproportionately older and often disproportionately Republican, at least recently. What the Democrats have taken out of these last couple of elections in Virginia and Alabama is that they can motivate their base, that people who don't ordinarily come out, except for in presidential years, have been willing to come out. And if they can do that, then that changes the dynamic, because there are folks sitting in these districts who normally sit out midterms, where turnout goes under 40% a lot of times. They reshape that, and the whole electorate changes.
Dan, let me ask you about the Senate. Karen sketched out the situation in the House. In the Senate, after Doug Jones of Alabama is seated as the Democrat next year, after that exciting race this year, there will be a two-seat majority for Republicans. That means that Democrats need to just pick up two seats to gain control of the Senate. Now, 10 Democrats are up for re-election in states that Donald Trump won. And in recent history, states have tended to vote for senator the way they have for president. So that's one factor there. There's only one Republican running in a state where Hillary Clinton won. That's in Nevada, Dean Heller. And then there are some other interesting states, Tennessee, and then Minnesota are on, and those are. So where do you see the Senate shaking out?
Well, I'd make two points. First of all, if we were having this conversation a year ago, we would be talking about the likelihood of potentially significant losses for the Democrats in the Senate because, as you say, they're defending so many seats and they're defending them in states that Trump won. Now, of those 10 that Trump won, five are truly red and five are what I would call more swing states. But what's happened over the course of the year is, because of the turbulence that the Republicans have run into, there is now at least the possibility of Democrats being able to take control of the Senate. I think it's still very, very difficult, but they have three opportunities: Arizona, Nevada, and possibly Tennessee, because they have a candidate there, the former Democratic governor, who may be the only Democrat who could win statewide, but I'm not predicting at this point that he will. And many of their incumbents are in reasonably good shape, or better shape than you might have thought 6 or 8 or 10 months ago. I think it's still a heavy lift for the Democrats to take over, but they at least have an opportunity which they wouldn't have dreamed of at the beginning of the Trump presidency.
Karen, when Dan talks about some of those Senate seats being in kind of more swingy areas, then so you've got the class of seats that are up where Democrats are trying to defend territory in West Virginia, where
right.
I think Trump won by 45 points. Then others are in Michigan, Wisconsin, which were closer. So how do you think, is that the distinction, another one we should be watching for, those Rust Belt states that flipped and went for Trump in the presidential, where people were surprised? How do you think that'll play out in the Senate elections?
Well, as it turns out, I spent some time this week in Michigan and actually looking at the governor's race there. What I found is that Democrats and act on that sort of activist base, the kind of people who are engaged now, are so traumatized by seeing what they thought were going to be easy wins for Hillary Clinton last time around that that also contributes to the enthusiasm factor. They were caught napping in 2016, and there is a determination, I think, not to have that happen again.
And, Anthony, another thing we should talk about with respect to the Senate is there are primaries to come. We saw in Alabama some extraordinary inter-party Republican fighting, comments, people even saying they were no longer Republicans after the Republican National Committee supported Roy Moore. How do you think the primary process plays out in terms of, well, just how do you think it plays out?
Yeah, definitely the thing to watch this spring. We could be sitting here a year from now, and the landscape will be very different because, look, behind all of this is which direction does each party go? right? And the Republicans are still having that conversation. We talked a lot about the sort of the more populist wing of the party, the part that is, you know, voting against anything seen as the establishment, anything seen as the elites, versus the more traditional conservative wing. And if you start to see primary challenges to sitting incumbent Republican senators in otherwise safe states, then you start to get a dynamic like you saw, or like many people think you saw in Alabama, where the Republicans could potentially nominate someone who can't appeal to a broader electorate, and then you get a potentially safe red seat that becomes in play. Look, it's the same thing on the Democratic side. I mean, they're still going to have a conversation about which direction their party goes, and so both parties are going to have to set that.
Dan, is that Democratic conversation delayed, though, by Democrats thinking, look, if we just run kind of against the president, we take advantage of this enthusiasm from our base, let's postpone the question about what exactly the Democratic Party means because we got a chance to play off of this? Or is there going to be a real conversation?
I think there will be a partial conversation, but I think at this point for most Democrats, the view is the harder they can go after the president tie their Republican opponent to the president, the better off they're going to do, and they will defer that conversation about who they are as a party for the 2020 Democratic nomination battle. They may pay some price for that. I'm not understating how significant that challenge will be for them, but I think for the midterm, focusing on the president. I mean, one of the problems that Republican candidates potentially face is how much do they identify with President Trump in order to energize their base? And the cost of that in a general election, if they become so identified that people think, well, it's just another Trumpian.
Right. The challenge that Ed Gillespie ran into in the Virginia gubernatorial race.
And there's also, though, you're finding that a lot of these Republicans who are running for the Senate are not willing, for instance, to commit to voting for Mitch McConnell to continue as their leader as well. I mean, on the one hand, they don't want to be too close to the establishment. On the other, they don't want to offend the base. So it's really a delicate act for a lot of them.
Anthony, how much do you think it's a danger for Democrats to not have something to run on, to just focus on the president? Because obviously, if they focus on the president, that encourages the Republican base to turn out.
One of the things that was so interesting in 2016, where, as you mentioned, the Democrats didn't win as many seats as some thought they might, is that voters said Donald Trump was a different kind of Republican. He was kind of a brand unto himself. And they had a hard time tying the Republican Senate candidate to Donald Trump. The question to watch is whether or not they can do that now, because so many people have seen the president as a sort of different brand altogether.
And the Washington Post, a paper you're familiar with, wrote a piece about how the president's dying to get out there and campaign. Both, we know all presidents love to get out and back in campaigns. It's so much more fun than what they have to do in Washington. But how does that work out, Dan? Is this going to be a situation where people think, go campaign somewhere else, Mr. President? Or, you know, he just spends his time in those safe districts and how do you think that plays out, his active participation?
Well, we know that he loves to get out, and we know that those big rallies energize him, and that he loves to do that, and that, you know, that he, you know, he creates enthusiasm as well as receives the energy back from it. He's going to want to be out there a fair amount. I think it will be difficult for a lot of these candidates to embrace him too closely in some of these competitive races. And so I think individually all of those candidates are going to have to decide, how close do I want the president to be? You know, Ed Gillespie, talking about Virginia, wanted to keep him somewhat at arm's length. It didn't matter in the end. He still got beat pretty badly.
Karen, how do you think the policy landscape is going to show up here? You know, are we going to have a bunch of fights that are going to be all about kind of values issues, cultural issues, the things that get voters excited? Or is there any way in which some policy might actually be a part of the conversation?
Well, the big policy issue right now, especially coming on the heels of the tax bill, is whether they are going to be brave enough to begin the real conversation on entitlements. That is an absolutely treacherous issue to bring up in an election year. And Mitch McConnell in the Senate has already said it ain't happening here unless there's some Democratic buy-in, which there won't be.
Right. All right. Well, go ahead quickly.
Oh, I was going to say, remember, the Republicans rely on older voters very heavily. And so that does certainly put things into a different context.
All right. Thanks, all of you. And we'll be right back.
CBS News Radio podcasts are now on Spotify. Listen to great shows like Face the Nation, the CBS News Weekend Roundup, CBS This Morning, and more. They're all from your Spotify app on your iOS or Android device. CBS News Radio on Spotify, the leading global music streaming service, now lets you find the right podcast for every moment. Open Spotify to listen to CBS News Radio podcasts today.
It's time now to take a look at perfect timing. We spoke earlier with best-selling author Daniel Pink. His new book is out in early January. It's called When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. You say this is not a how-to book, but a when-to book. Tell people what that means.
Well, we tend to think that timing is an art. We make our decisions about when to do things based on gut instinct and intuition. But timing is actually a science. Across multiple disciplines, there's a huge body of research showing us how to make systematically better, evidence-based decisions about when to do things. And it turns out they have a material effect on our well-being, on our productivity, on our performance, on our creativity, on our health, many, many domains of life.
What I love is also the way in which it's not just, you know, are you a morning person or an evening person, although you have a great explanation and description and a little test on how you can figure out who you are in that group, but it's also when you choose to do certain kinds of thinking, like creative thinking versus, explain that for people.
Absolutely. Well, what a whole range of scientists have found is that the day has a hidden pattern. It's basically a peak, a trough, and a rebound. Now, most of us proceed through the day in that order, peak, trough, rebound. And it turns out we're better off doing analytic work during the peak, which for most of us is the morning. The trough is not good for anything. It's actually a danger zone in many ways. We're better off doing our administrative stuff during the trough. But then during the recovery, it turns out we're better at more creative tasks, tasks that require a little bit more looseness rather than that heads-down, locked-in approach.
And is that's when the flashes of insight come?
Often, because when we're at our peak, we're very vigilant, right? We're able to keep out distractions. That's a feature when you're doing the analytic work. But when you're doing creative work, you actually want a little bit more looseness. You want to let a few distractions in so to mix up the soup a little bit. And so during the recovery period, which again for most of us is the late afternoon, early evening, we do better on what are called insight tasks.
Has human history fouled us up by, which is to say, we needed to create time and watches and hours so we know when the bus arrives.
Yeah.
But did we figure out a system that's basically always fighting with our own natural rhythms?
It's a really, really interesting question because, you know, one of the things that what I discovered researching time itself is that a lot of things that we think of as natural are completely human inventions designed to corral time. So an hour has no natural substance to it. A minute doesn't have any natural substance to it. Certainly a year does because the planet goes around. A day does because the planet spins on its axis. But beyond that, we're always trying to corral time. And it's very hard to do, and time is a very elusive subject. And one of the things that's happened is that I think as a consequence, when we think about our own performance, we focus on what we're going to do. We focus on often how we're going to do it. We're focused on who we're going to do it with. But we put when questions over there at the kids' table saying that it's not that important. And the science is telling us that it's actually demonstrably important.
Right. It's the thing you should put at the front. One of the things I love about the book is there's a lot of practical news you can use, as we
absolutely
say. So give people a little sense of that, both in your day-to-day, but also, you know, you talk, for example, about midlife and the guidance that. So give us a sense of those how-to.
There are all kinds of things. Number one is that if you think about the science of breaks. Not too many years ago, people who stayed up all night were kind of heroes in the workplace because they were tougher than the rest of us. Then the science of sleep began emerging, and we said, no, those people are fools. I think the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was a decade ago, about to break through the surface as a really, really instructive about how we can work better. So we need to take more breaks, period. And one of the best things that I've done myself is that every day I have a break list. I write down two breaks I'm going to take during the day. We also know from the science that breaks are better taken with other people rather than solo, even for introverts like me. They're better taken fully detached rather than semi-detached. That is, don't bring your phone. We're better off moving during our breaks than being stationary. We're also better off being near nature. And so what the science is telling us is that if we take these regular breaks, 10, 15 minutes, we're going to feel better, we're going to perform higher. So make a break list. That's one of my favorite tips.
And go outside while you're doing
if you can. If you can. But there's even evidence that just looking out a window and seeing a tree is better than being in a windowless room.
Let me also ask you about teams, and because how timing works when you're working with lots of other people as well.
Yeah, well, there's some really, really interesting research on how teams synchronize, things like choirs, rowing teams, delivery services. And one of the things that it's so interesting about our nature is that it seems that coordinating with other people, being in sync and in time with other people, there's something fundamentally human about that. And we have a propensity for it. And one of the things that's so interesting about that, if you look at, let's take exercise as an example. Exercise is absolutely good for you, right? It boosts your mood. It's a prophylactic against depression. It helps control your weight. It's all good. Well, there's kind of a new exercise out there, and it's choral singing of all things. Choral singing has benefits that are just extraordinary at the physiological level and the psychological level. It is useful for cancer patients. It improves your immune response. It boosts your mood. So there's something about synchronizing with other people that makes us feel good. It also helps when kids do synchronous activities, they actually afterwards are a little bit more what social psychologists call pro-social. That is, they will play with kids who aren't like them. They're more likely to cooperate. They're more likely to help.
So we all should join roving bands of walking singers.
On our breaks, yes.
Right, exactly.
Well, I mean, I think there's some good evidence for, like in schools, that choral groups, not only as kind of an ancillary activity, but as something that actually boosts the moods of kids, improves their social and emotional learning, and could conceivably make them better citizens of the school.
All right, Daniel Pink, that's it. Thanks so much for being with
us. Thank you, John.
Daniel Pink's book is When? The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. We'll be back in a moment. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. We here at Face the Nation want to wish everyone watching a Merry Christmas, visions of sugar plums, and a very happy holiday season. I'm John Dickerson. Today's guests were CBS News correspondents Margaret Brennan, Major Garrett, Jeff Pagaz, David Martin, and contributor Ed O'Keefe. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Jill Jackson and Ed Forgetson. The broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.